blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. And nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والعصر إن الإنسان لفي خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر. السلام عليكم.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آل محمد.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Everyone, first and foremost, thank you all for attending this event. A little bit about the organization that is collaborating with other organizations is RISE. Last year, RISE, which stands for Resist, Initiate, Support, and Educate, over the current issues, especially dealing with the Israeli and the Palestinian conflict, as well as local issues. That's what we covered. So last year, we had Let's Talk Palestine, and that essentially built up to the Quds rally that was held in Ramadan. As far as you know, last year the rally was a huge success. Thousands came along and supported the cause. And so this year we're doing the same thing, and we have invited Ms. Allison Weir this year. Last night she spoke at University of Houston. We were collaborating with a student for justice in Palestine. Today she's speaking at IEC, Islamic Education Center. And tomorrow she will be speaking at the CARE banquet dealing with local activism in the Houston area. So RISE has been very active as far as building the momentum, and so as discussed, this event and bringing her is the initiation point and promoting the message of Quds and building up to the rally. And so we have 3 months. A lot of people might be asking, 3 months is a bit earlier, but it takes a lot of time and commitment and a huge contribution from all the community members as well as outside communities to come together and have a successful rally for this cause. So a little bit about Ms. Weir. She is a journalist by profession. She graduated from the University of Michigan. And then soon after, she went through this experience in Palestine, and she generated, and she's the founder of two organizations. One is for If Americans Knew, which educates and influences Americans of how the Americans play a vital role in our foreign policy as far as Israel is concerned. And the second one is the Council for the National Interest Foundation. Both of them were founded by Ms. Allison Weir, and she has written a new book. She's the author of Against Our Better Judgment, dealing with the same cause and the same issue, the Israeli and the Palestinian issue. So after the loudest of salawat, I would like to invite Ms. Allison Weir for tonight's lectures.
Turn it on, and I failed at both of them. So we'll see how it goes. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here tonight. If I'm not holding the microphone close enough, or if you cannot hear me, please wave and let me know. My voice is a little weak these days, so let me know if I need to try to be a little bit louder. I'm very grateful to RISE for organizing these events for me to be here in Houston. I've had a wonderful event at the University of Houston, and I'm so pleased to be here today. Thank you so much. Tonight, I'll be talking, some of what I say tonight, you of course will know quite well, but this also will show you, this is how I try to speak to the general public about this very important issue of Israel-Palestine. I specifically talk about the U.S. connection. As we know, Americans hear a great deal about Israel. Thanks to groups like RISE and your organization, they're beginning sometimes to hear about Palestine. But I don't think we often enough hear about the American connection and the history of that connection. So that's especially what I'll focus on tonight. The American media cover this issue quite a bit, as we know. Some aspects are frequently reported on. For example, rockets from Gaza are mentioned in every report about Gaza, about Palestine, about Israel. We always hear that thousands of rockets have been fired from Gaza into Israel. That's factual. We should know it. We do know it. There was even a headline in the New York Times a while ago that talked about Gaza rocket fire intensifies. But given that they tell Americans every time about thousands of rockets, they tell us very little about those rockets. For example, the fact that they are almost always small homemade projectiles. That's usually not told to people. They also give us one statistic of sorts. They tell us thousands of rockets, but they don't tell us in the whole time, over 12 years, that these rockets have been fired, how many people in Israel have they killed? You know, at least a ballpark number. They tell us thousands of rockets over and over again. Well, I counted that up a while ago, and it was 29 people. Now, most Americans, I believe strongly, want to be fair-minded, want the whole picture. So a fair-minded person wants to know, well, how many people in Gaza were killed during that same period that these rockets killed 29 people? That number is easily obtainable. The last time I looked, it was approximately 5,700 Gazans. It's higher than that. So the media, for the most part, in fact, always, are giving Americans a very filtered news coverage. They cover Israeli children's deaths in great detail. We often learn their names, we see their parents, we grieve for those children, as we should. But we almost never learn about the Palestinian children killed during that same period. In fact, if you go back here, sorry. We learn about the Israeli children, but we almost never learn about the Palestinian children. And if you look at this, I feel that we should learn about all of these children. If you'll notice this, this is from the round of violence that began in fall of 2000. 91 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child was killed. In fact, 140 Palestinians of all ages were killed before a single Israeli in Israel was killed. And yet, the American media consistently tell Americans that Israel is retaliating, when chronologically it is the opposite. I like to believe, and I do believe, that if the American public knew that Israel was using our tax money to kill children, the number one cause of the deaths of these 91 children was gunfire to the head. If Americans knew that, we would have demanded that it stop. And if we had done that, it might have stopped. If the American public demanded that, it probably would stop. And if that had happened, all of those other columns, all of those other children, both Palestinian and Israeli children, could be living today if the media had told Americans about them. That's the number up through last year. How I became involved. Many people ask that because I don't happen to be Jewish or Muslim or Arab or Palestinian. And so I'm from a Christian background. And so, like the large majority of Americans, I knew almost nothing about this issue 14 years ago. I was the editor of a very small weekly newspaper in Northern California, writing about the city council, the school district. The Middle East seemed distant, confusing, and irrelevant to my daily life. That's the way it seems to most Americans. But then in fall of 2000, when the second Palestinian uprising began, and it was in the news for a period of time, I decided to pay attention, to try to just follow the news coverage and learn what Israel-Palestine was all about. And when I finally did that so late in my life, I quickly noticed, as a journalist, that our news coverage was very one-sided. I noticed that we heard from and about Israelis in great detail,
as we should, as I wanted to, but I also expected and wanted to hear from and about Palestinians in equivalent detail. But I noticed that came much less frequently. And I wanted the whole story, the whole picture. So I began to go to the internet to try to learn what was going on. It was, as I say, it was in, back in 2000. It was sort of new to use Google to search, but I started to do that. And I discovered that there were Palestinian media and Israeli media in English on the internet, and humanitarian organizations in the region that were reporting on this every day. And that's where I learned that large numbers of largely unarmed demonstrators were being killed every day. But I learned something more from a report in an Israeli newspaper about a study by an Israeli academic. I read that the strategy that Israel was using was not to kill too many, because if they killed too many, they realized, the world might pay attention and might do something about it. So they weren't apparently killing too many, but they were injuring multitudes. In the first month alone, Israeli forces injured at least 6,000 men, women, and children. And in fact, snipers were specifically targeting, and remember, this information is from an Israeli newspaper. They were specifically targeting knees and eyes. I also, in my research, learned that Americans give Israel over $8 million per day. In fact, it's closer to $10 million per day. This is the conservative number. That means we give Israel, all of us that are taxpayers, we are giving Israel far more of our tax money than goes to any other country in the world. Far more than to all the starving countries of Africa put together. That means that what Israel is doing, we are responsible for. When I learned that, I realized, wait, this is perhaps the most covered up issue I've ever seen. The more I looked into it, the more disturbed I became. And after a while, I decided that I needed to go and see for myself what was going on, if it was truly as bad as I was beginning to believe that it was. And so began the most unusual trip I've ever taken in my life. Many years before, I had been in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan. In that case, I had a very official support system helping and guiding me, the Peace Corps. In this case, I was going to be traveling alone, and I had no one guiding or sponsoring my trip whatsoever. As I landed on February 7th, I tried to ignore the fear. What was it going to be like for me as a single female American to wander alone through a largely Muslim land that was in the middle of a violent uprising and that was at the epicenter of a region we are continually told is hostile to Americans and to women? What would it be like? What I discovered as I traveled very randomly and haphazardly throughout the West Bank and Gaza Strip is that these were myths that are as false as they are believed by many Americans. I was treated with respect. I was completely safe. Whenever people learned I was an American, and I always told them that, the response always was welcome on that trip and on my trip since. But we rarely see pictures like this. Most Americans don't know this is what it's like there. I also saw that there was more going on, because I learned that already at that time, in early 2000, Palestinians were often living in small prisons within larger prisons. You often couldn't go to the next town to go to school, to go to work, to go to the hospital to deliver your baby. There were Israeli checkpoints in between blocking your way. And by checkpoints, as you know, I don't mean toll booths. I mean soldiers in combat gear with machine guns. I grew used to, almost, arriving at a street corner in Gaza and seeing young soldiers with a machine gun aimed straight at you. You hoped they waved you on rather than shooting you, as they had done some people. At night, you couldn't really see those soldiers sitting in their tank, but you could see the flashlight with which they signaled whether or not you were allowed to continue driving, to continue living. That was just routine. That was in the good parts of town. But I saw more. In some parts of Gaza, I saw entire neighborhoods that were bullet-riddled. Can you hear me okay? Entire residential neighborhoods that were destroyed. And remember, I always emphasize this when I speak before all audiences, of course, especially the general public. These pictures I took myself, this is what Gaza looked like before a single rocket had been fired. No rockets had been fired yet, and this is what was going on. This is several years before Hamas was elected. Remember, the media always say that Israel is defending itself from the rockets and from the terrorists, you know, the Hamas government that was elected. And yet, this is going on in early 2001. As I went through this area, by the way, crowds of people came up to welcome me and smile at me and show me their Swiss cheese homes. At one point, as I was going around this area, there was suddenly Israeli gunfire very close. People took me away from the gunfire to a place that we hoped was safer. As I was going around that area, however, I at first thought that Israeli gunfire that was nearby was just a coincidence. But then as I thought about it more, I think that was very naive. Because I had looked over sandbag barricades and seen those Israeli guard towers overlooking us. And I have no doubt that those soldiers saw that a foreigner was wandering around. And I suspect they finally decided to send her a message. Don't come here. Don't see what we're doing. But I did see. I saw beautiful agricultural lands being destroyed. A stand of 100-year-old date palms had been flattened, ancient olive groves. I talked to farmers who had farmed there forever. Their fathers and grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers had farmed that land. And now they were destroyed. I wondered how they would feed their children. How do you feed your children when everything is destroyed, when your very orchards are destroyed? I saw a people and a land being destroyed with our tax money. To me, that is newsworthy. And I saw more. I don't like seeing suffering or children in pain. But since thousands of children have been injured through the use of our tax money, it was my job to see them. And all I had to do was go to the nearest hospital, where I saw children with bullets in their backs, in their stomachs, in their heads. I saw a brain-dead 12-year-old. And I saw some parents that were happy to see me as an American, because they thought this, I don't have this boy's picture, but they thought that perhaps I could help their poor son. So I asked the doctor if there was care that could be provided. Maybe a surgical team could be flown in, or maybe their son could be flown to a hospital back in the United States. But the doctor told me that he hadn't yet found the right time and the right way to tell those parents, but that their son was totally and eternally paralyzed. And so I knew something they didn't know, and I wished that I didn't. And I saw much more. I won't go into every detail because you all have known about this. Perhaps some of you have lived it. But I was in the home of a small boy who had just been killed. I saw his parents when they got back from the hospital, and I heard the mother and the sisters weeping and weeping. And I saw the father walking around shell-shocked. It looked like he was sleepwalking in a bad dream that will never end. And I saw funerals. And lots of funerals. There were funerals every day. And then on my other trips, I've seen a wall that's being created on confiscated land, imprisoning the people still further. And Bethlehem, as you know, is very, very sacred to Christians. And this is the way that Christians are supposed to get out of Bethlehem, if they're even allowed out, which they often are not. And that's what Gaza looked like the last time I visited there. And so when I came back from that trip, I decided to start an organization called If Americans Knew. It wasn't if Muslims knew, if Jews knew, if Christians knew. It wasn't if liberals knew, if conservatives knew. It was if we all knew. Because it's my view, if we all knew, we would demand that it stop. Because we could do that. And we especially focused on media coverage, because it's very important to recognize that in a democracy, in a republic, which the United States is, the media is the most powerful institution, because that is how people get the information that they think they know about many issues, especially international issues. So we looked at the media coverage to try to figure out what was going on and why it is so broken. My son is a scientist. I like the idea of a study that is as immune to subjective bias as possible, that is quantitative. And we decided to look at how the media covered deaths among both populations. To me, all deaths are tragic. We especially looked at the first year of that uprising, because first impressions are so powerful. They're what give the context within which people ever after view a conflict. That first year, first impressions determine for people which population they think is just defending themselves and which initiated the violence. It's a very important time period. We also looked at a subcategory of children being killed. I think all people are deeply saddened when we hear about a child injured or killed, regardless of the race, religion, or ethnicity. But many are being killed. So we needed to answer that question, how many, and how did the media cover that? We discovered that 28 Israeli children had been killed, and at least 131 Palestinian children had been killed that first year. How was that covered by our primetime network news shows, ABC, CBS, NBC, mainstream? Well, we found that they reported on Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on Palestinian children's deaths. They had follow-up reports on Israeli children's deaths so often that they exceeded 100% coverage, whereas for Palestinian children, the coverage never even came close to 100%. This is some media we have found report on Palestinian deaths so minimally, children's deaths, that many people don't even know they're going on, even though they occurred first and in far greater numbers. We also looked at the New York Times. This is considered the newspaper of record. This is the newspaper that intellectuals all across the United States read. In this case, we decided to graph our data chronologically for that first year, those first 12 months. So I'll show you the first curve will be the New York Times reporting on Israeli children killed that first year. Next, we'll see the actual death curve of Israeli children killed that first year, which is lower, but a similar curve. Next, we'll see the New York Times reporting on Palestinian children killed that first year, which is lower, but a similar curve again. They're all sort of along the same curve. Next, I'll show you the actual death curve of Palestinian children killed by Israelis that year. Many people, especially liberals and intellectuals, listen to National Public Radio, NPR, and will say, well, I know what's going on because I listen to NPR. Pro-Israel organizations often attack NPR, claiming that it is pro-Palestinian in its coverage. So an organization called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, a media watchdog group that looks into journalism on many issues, decided to study NPR's coverage on Israel-Palestine. And their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent job. He discovered that, yes, indeed, NPR is very distorted in its coverage on this issue. But once again, in a pro-Israel direction. He gave his study a brilliant title. He called it The Illusion of Balance, because he found that NPR had carried almost the exact same number of news reports on Israeli children's deaths as on Palestinian children's deaths, making it look like that was just balanced, objective reporting. But in reality, that wasn't balance. That meant that they were reporting on almost all the deaths among the Israeli population and very few of the deaths among the Palestinian population. That's distortion, I would suggest. That's manipulation. We looked at the San Jose Mercury News. This is just a very typical daily newspaper in Silicon Valley near Stanford University. In this case, we just looked at front page headlines. Many people are very busy and may just look at the front page headlines for that day. But that's supposed to be the big news of the day, the important news of the day. So we decided to evaluate that coverage. First, of course, we needed a baseline to evaluate the coverage, how many people among both populations had been killed. Once again, as in every time period, Palestinians were killed in far greater numbers than Israelis. How is this covered in front page headlines? Well, they had reversed the situation and increased the differential. So while that was going on, sorry, this is just. That's what it was looking like to people. It occurred to me, I was shocked, it occurred to me that what if the Mercury News had reported the Super Bowl backwards? What if they'd gotten the World Series wrong and had reversed the score? They were committing a distortion of that magnitude and nobody was even noticing it. Then something else I noticed in the last 14 years. Just about every time there is Palestinian violence that takes Israeli lives, they say that it has shattered a period of calm. We see this, I've seen this phrase over and over again in headlines and in news stories, that a period of calm has been shattered by Palestinian violence. There was a headline like that in 2005 in the Los Angeles Times. I was living in Los Angeles at that time, and I saw the website headline long before it would be actually printed in the newspaper the next day. So I called up the LA Times to correct their headline. Because I said during a period that they said had been calm, in reality, 170 Palestinian men, women, and children had been killed. And that during a period they said was calm, 379 had been injured. Their response to me was, we said relative calm. And they didn't change the headline or put in any of this factual information. There are other omissions that are significant. I'll just mention a few. There is dissent in Israel. There are a number of groups that oppose their government, and that's almost never reported to us. There is a very active nonviolence movement. This has been going on for years, largely in small villages. people are trying to use Gandhian nonviolence, and they are being met with Israeli violence in return. They are often joined by people from around the world, of all ages and ethnicities. Some Israelis are joining with Palestinians in these peaceful marches, and yet our media almost never report about them, even though they go on every single week. And it's very courageous because of the violence that they meet from Israeli forces. Many people have been killed taking part in these. And remember, the power of nonviolence, as we know from Gandhi, the power of nonviolence comes from the world seeing it. When the world doesn't see it, the power is gone and the risk is great. Some of those killed were foreigners. Rachel Corey was 23 years old. Tom Herndahl was 21 years old. He was trying to help schoolgirls away from danger. Almost no coverage of that at all. Sorry, the clicker is a little. Another omission is very different. It's not about something that took place on the other side of the world and therefore maybe was hard to cover. This took place right in the United States in Washington, D.C. in 2003. There was a briefing on Capitol Hill by a very distinguished panel into the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. This panel was chaired by Admiral Thomas Moore, who had been a four-star admiral and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That is about the highest rank you can have. With him that day as part of the panel was Rear Admiral Merlin Starry. He had been in charge of the whole legal department of the U.S. Navy. Also part of their commission was a Marine general, and not just any general. This man was the highest ranking Congressional Medal of Honor in the United States. That is the highest medal that an American military person can win. They announced their findings on Capitol Hill that Israel had tried to sink a U.S. Navy ship, that Israel had injured over 170 Americans, killed 34, that this constituted an act of war by Israel against the United States of America. They also announced that rescue flights to these men had been recalled by the Secretary of Defense and by the President, and that this incident was ordered covered up by the President of the United States. Statements of that gravity made by high military officials on Capitol Hill are newsworthy, and yet they were not covered in the Washington Post, the New York Times, Fox News, USA Today, all ignored it. It was covered in the Stars and Stripes newspaper, the military newspaper abroad. And it's in the Congressional Record, where you can read every detail about what went on. Let's look at the recent Israel-Gaza wars. I know you know about these, but your neighbors probably don't. So let's just look at these numbers. ...2008, 2009, those are the deaths. That's not what a war looks like. Our media call this a war. That is not a war. That's a massacre. That's the term one would use. Then we look at the next one. Well, not the very next one, but the next big one. 2014, last summer. Now, the media coverage, I'm sure you'll recall, of the sequence of events that led to the next, quote, war, they begin that sequence with June 12th, when three young Israelis were abducted and tragically murdered. That's when they say that it started, of course, with Palestinian violence. Well, let's look at the preceding months. Let's start from the beginning of 2014, and let's look at both populations because we care about all human beings. And we discover that in January, Palestinians were killed, including a child, but apparently that wasn't newsworthy. Then we look at the next month, and we see more Palestinians killed, but again, that's not newsworthy. Then we'll look at March. And again, we see more Palestinians killed, including a child again. But again, not newsworthy to our media. Then we look at the next month, and there is one soldier and one Palestinian. And then we look at May, and we see again more Palestinians killed, including two children. But none of that is considered in the coverage. Then we get to June, and we see two more Palestinians killed, but then we see the three Israelis. And that's when they dated from. So of course, by starting with that event, it looks like Israel is responding. Those are the numbers afterwards. And of course, they grew and grew and grew. Then let's look at another topic. Let's look at abductions, kidnappings. Because when those three Israelis were kidnapped, it was major news. There were headlines everywhere. This is what, you know, your fellow Americans heard about. This is sort of what we're dealing with. So they heard about three young people being kidnapped. Naturally, everybody is sympathetic when somebody has been kidnapped. Well, let's look and see if any Palestinians have ever been abducted by Israelis, by Israeli forces, and look at the total number, and there's what we have. This is the filtered, the missing information that we need to give to Americans. Then the aftermath. Typical news coverage of a disaster tells people about what's going on after the hurricane, after the earthquake, after the tsunami. We see people suffering, trying to put their lives back together. Our hearts go out to them. We send usually charity or food and clothing. And yet Palestinians, huge numbers homeless, huge numbers injured, with most of their hospitals damaged and destroyed, and yet that's invisible to most Americans, right? When other human beings massively need our help, we don't even learn about it. So when I began to learn all of this was very shocking to me. When I began to learn this, I began to study it and read about it and try to understand what was going on and where the Israeli-Palestinian conflict began. You know this. But I was surprised, I guess, to really understand that when I was born, there was no Israel. It didn't exist. So where did this conflict come from? Of course, Palestine existed. And so when you look back to try to find where the conflict began, it's very important. I'm going into this. You know it. But most Americans, this is what we need to explain to them, because many people are led to believe that this is a conflict that has gone on for thousands of years, that it's a religious conflict, and that's false. If you look back at Palestine in the late 1800s, you find that it was, in a sense, multicultural, 80% Muslim, 15% Christian, about 5% Jewish, all living together without conflict, as they had done for centuries. There are ancient churches, ancient synagogues. There was not any kind of violent conflict. So where did the conflict come from? Why did this violence begin? It didn't start in the region. It didn't start between Jews, Christians, and Muslims who were living there side by side. It began with an ideological, political movement that began in Europe, and very soon, this was the surprise to me, in the United States. It's a movement. It was not a religious movement at first. For many years, it was considered highly heretical by observant Jews, by the large majority of observant Jews. It was called political Zionism. a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine, which meant pushing out 95% of the people living on the land. That's what that meant. Now, my focus tonight is my book and the American connection. So I'll tell a little bit about what went on here. I was very surprised to learn this. Zionism has been very active in my own country for well over a century. And yet, although I had grown up here, my parents grew up here, some of my grandparents, I have ancestors who go back to the very beginning of the United States, some. And yet, I had never known that there was a very significant movement in the United States called political Zionism that has impacted my country profoundly negatively, impacted the Middle East tragically, and impacted the whole world dangerously. And yet, if you went outside and asked the typical American, what do you think of Zionism? What do you think of Zionists? They would probably have no idea what it is. Maybe they would answer the way I think I probably would have before. I probably would have said something like, I think I've heard that word. What does it mean? We've heard of capitalism, socialism, fascism, and yet here's a very significant ideology operating in our country for a long time that most Americans have never even heard of. By 1910, it was already a significant movement. It was already a movement to which congressmen, especially in the larger cities, were listening to. It had some businessmen, professors, lawyers. It was a small segment of the Jewish American population. For many decades, most Jewish Americans were not Zionists. But the Zionist movement was significant already in 1910. Then in 1914, there was a very significant development that most people don't really know about. A very prominent Boston attorney named Louis Brandeis became a Zionist, and in fact, he became the leader of World Zionism. World Zionism had been in Europe, but it moved to the United States in 1914. For a period of time, it was centered in the US. Louis Brandeis wasn't just a significant attorney. Two years later, he was close friends with Woodrow Wilson. Sorry, the clicker isn't really clicking.
Aim it this way.
Okay. In 1916, he became a Supreme Court Justice. That, of course, as you know, is a very, very high, important position. So when you become a Supreme Court Justice, the normal ethical practice is to resign any kind of affiliations or memberships because you are supposed to be neutral and unbiased. So he pretended to resign his leadership of World Zionism, but in reality, he continued to lead it from within his Supreme Court chambers. This is mentioned in a number of books. If you get my book, everything I say is thoroughly cited. I only want to know accurate information. But this is well known, it's just that most of us don't know it. So what would happen is his loyal lieutenants would come into the Supreme Court chambers and report about their activities, and he would give them directives to go and carry out. That was very shocking to me. Of course, it was completely unethical, which is why he did it secretly. But it was even worse than that. And I'll tell you my sources, because it's very important to know whether information's accurate or not. Anybody can say anything. So the way I did my research is I would read books that seemed reliable. I would look at the footnotes to see where that information came from. then would often order those books and read those footnotes, order those books and read those footnotes, on and on, to find out, to make sure this was all correct. So one of the books that I read was a very mainstream book published by a very mainstream establishment publisher. The author was a very establishment journalist named Peter Gross. He had been the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He was at Harvard. He has written several important nonfiction books. In this book, he tells that Louis Brandeis was a leader of a secret society that pushed Zionism in the United States. Now, this isn't, you know, maybe a fraternity boy kind of escapade. This was while he was a sitting Supreme Court justice. That's a shocking revelation. So I looked to see what was Peter Gross's evidence for that shocking allegation. And I discovered, I went to his footnote and I got that source. It was a scholarly journal, a very respected journal. The American Jewish Historical Quarterly had an article saying that. So I looked into the article, I found out, I looked into, well, who wrote that article? Is this a reliable scholar? And it turned out it was an Israeli professor from an Israeli university who wrote this article and provided this information, that there was a secret society, Parashim, called Parashim, meant separate, and Pharisees. The idea was to spread out and plant the idea of Zionism with Americans, especially high-level, important Americans. Also, they worked abroad to a degree. There was even, they would even undergo a solemn ceremony where they would promise to work for Zionism above even country, family, school. As early as 1915, this article wrote, and Peter Gross especially wrote from additional information, by 1915, a leader of the Parashim suggested that Britain would benefit from a declaration in support of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. To most people, this is very puzzling. What would Britain have to do with Palestine? Because remember, Palestine at that time was under the Ottoman Empire, not under the British Empire. Those of you that have heard of the Balfour Declaration, though, may, you know, be suspecting a connection there, and of course there was. So let's think why the British would have a connection, why the British might benefit from such a declaration suggested by a leader of the Parashim, an American. Well, remember what was going on at that time in Europe. The Great War, as was called at the time. Massive, massive carnage. The British, in the first day of battle, the Battle of the Somme, first day of battle, lost 50,000 men. They were desperate for the U.S. to come in on their side. Both sides, both the Germans and the British, wanted America to come in on their side of that war. But the American public did not want to go to war. Usually, Americans don't want to go to war. They did not want to go to a war in a foreign area, a pointless war that had nothing whatsoever to do with Americans. In fact, Woodrow Wilson was elected to his second term of office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But as we know, he didn't. The U.S. did enter World War I. Well, the Zionists saw this carnage as an opportunity. Britain was desperate. So the Zionist leaders, especially Chaim Weizmann, who is very important, went to the British government and claimed that the Zionists had the power, especially through Louis Brandeis, who was a close friend of Woodrow Wilson. They claimed that they could influence the U.S. to enter that war on the side of Britain. If Britain, in return, would then promise that they would facilitate the Zionist colonization of Palestine. This is mentioned in a number of books. This was called the Gentleman's Agreement between the British government and the Zionist leadership. This is how they got the Balfour Declaration. In which, by the way, the Balfour Declaration that I'm sure many of you have heard of was not written by Lord Balfour. It was written by a secret Zionist named Leopold Amory. And the actual text of that declaration, supposedly by Lord Balfour, went back and forth to the United States to help draft what the text would say. It was a way to open the door to Zionism and to the creation of Israel. Then after World War I, there was the peace conference in which the Ottoman Empire, having been defeated, was divided up. And the British at that time took the mandate and became in charge of Palestine beginning at that time. And then they did, to a degree, they did open up immigration, Jewish immigration to Palestine. Then it's not surprising to think what happened at that point. It increased, there was violence. Eventually, an indigenous population becomes aware that they're being pushed out. So there began to be violence between those two groups. Then as now, innocent lives on both sides were lost. Then as now, the large majority of those killed were the Palestinians. The Zionists formed two terror groups called the Irgun and the Stern Gang. The leaders of those terror groups became prime ministers of Israel later. So Israel's always condemning terrorism, but their prime ministers were terrorists, two of them. But again, we're looking at the U.S. connection. Well, what I had not known was that there were front groups in the United States that had operatives working for those terror groups that went to the United States. The Irgun sent several people to operate in the United States. One of them was named Hillel Cook. But in the United States, he went by the name of Peter Bergson. His group was called the Bergson Boys. So they operated clandestinely and covertly with false names for the organizations that they started, and they funneled money and weaponry to terror groups in Palestine. At one point, I learned about a plot by an American rabbi who went to Paris. This was after the war, 1947. The Zionists, after the war and before the war, the Zionists hated the British, even though they had facilitated Zionism to quite a degree. But the British periodically saw that this immigration to Palestine was resulting in massive violence. So they would periodically try to restrict Jewish immigration to Palestine. And then the Zionists would kill British for doing that. So in 1947, an American rabbi named Baruch Korff decided that his plot, they were connected to the Stern Gang, he was in Paris, they would go fly an airplane over London and drop bombs on the foreign ministry. The first plan had been to bomb Parliament. Remember, Britain had just defeated Hitler. They just fought Hitler. They were going to bomb London because of this, what they disliked. And there was one problem. They had the money for the plane. Apparently that was no problem. But they didn't know how to fly it. So they needed to find an aviator. They recruited a young American who was in Paris named Reginald Gilbert. Gilbert pretended to go along with the plot, but he secretly went to the American embassy, and they went to the Paris police and Scotland Yard, revealed the plot, and a week later, when they were going to take off with those incendiary bombs, they were instead arrested. This is how it stopped. By the way, at one point, Gilbert asked them, he said, well, what if I can't find the foreign ministry? You know, with the London fogs, they didn't have the kind of instruments we have today, and apparently that was a concern. And Korff said, it doesn't matter, just drop them anywhere. Kill anyone, all of London, all British are our enemy. By the way, that story is only in my book. Nobody else has it. I just, with the internet, I was able to find all of these newspapers. It was headline news at the time. All around the U.S., all the local newspapers had it. The British newspapers had it as well. I was curious about what happened to the two men in later life, and I learned that Baruch Korff, the leader of that plot, had later become a close friend of Richard Nixon, and even reportedly helped to influence Nixon on his Middle East policies. And Nixon, in sort of a friendly, fond fashion, called Korf his rabbi. Now, the precursor to today's AIPAC, this very, very powerful lobbying organization, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that largely, actually, sometimes literally, writes the legislation that our congresspeople from both parties pass. The precursor, direct precursor, came in 1940 with a group called the American Zionist Emergency Council. By 1943, they had $500,000. That's a lot of money now, but back then, remember, a nickel would buy a loaf of bread. By 1949, they had what is the equivalent in today's dollars of $1 billion with which to manipulate the American public. And they used it very well. It's not just money, it's also using it effectively. And they did. They targeted congressmen, Christian clergy, editors, professors, both business and labor. They went across the political spectrum. That's important to do. And they went after Jewish war veterans as well. As I said, the Jewish population was originally not Zionist, but they were targeted for propaganda. They funded studies. They had 400 committees around the United States. I cover all this in more detail in my book. They worked to, they specifically, by the way, worked to try to create Christian support for Zionism, and of course they had a lot of success there also. But during all of this time, there was major opposition to Zionism by establishment portions of the United States. It was opposed by Christian leaders, by the State Department, the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies opposed it, a number of Jewish organizations opposed Zionism, but none were quite as manipulative. So they didn't win the battle at that point. The battle's not over. But, you know, two of the most celebrated Christian pastors opposed Zionism for religious and moral grounds. A Dead Sea scholar who was very prominent named Willard Burroughs wrote a wonderful book saying that Palestine is our business, saying it was our responsibility to help Palestinians. A Jewish anti-Zionist named Alfred Lilienthal wrote several excellent books exposing Zionism and opposing it. The State Department, beginning in 1912, opposed Zionism. In 1919, there was a commission that Woodrow Wilson sent to the region to see, to investigate, should a Jewish state be created there. And they said this would be a grave trespass on the rights of the people there. It would be profoundly wrong. It was a very strong report, but it was buried and had no impact. Then in the 30s and the 40s, the State Department and the Pentagon and the Intelligence Department, they were writing memos after memos, reports, studies, all recommending that supporting Zionism would be damaging to the United States, that it would interfere with our strategic needs, and that it was also counter to American principles. Dean Acheson was a major statesman. He said it would imperil the United States. The Secretary of Defense was outraged that a domestic lobby was running American foreign policy to a degree already by that time. Harry Truman said basically what every president almost says since that time from both parties. I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents. So rather than taking the policies that were in the best interests of the United States and that were moral, he worked to get elected. Even though his Secretary of State, George Marshall, a very famous war hero, the author of the Marshall Plan, his Secretary of State even said to Truman, if you sacrifice U.S. interests just to get elected, I won't even vote for you. But Truman did that. So then in 1947, the British, with all of the violence, turned the question of Palestine over to the United Nations. Now, many people think that the United Nations created Israel. It did not. But here's what happened. Under great pressure and threats and bribes, the Zionists pushed through what's called a partition recommendation, in which 55% of Palestine would be given to a Jewish state and the Palestinians would be left with 45%. Even after decades of immigration, the Jewish population was still only 30% and owned less than 10% of the land, this would give them 55%. So it was, of course, a great deal for the Zionists. However, that had no force of law. Although it passed the General Assembly just barely through force of through bribes and threats, it did not go to the Security Council. It never was adopted as international law, so it did not create any states. If it had created Israel, it would have also created Palestine. But it did not create any states. What the way Israel was created was very clearly by warfare. It was created by a war of what an Israeli historian quite accurately calls ethnic cleansing. Ilan Pappe, an excellent Israeli historian, has written that book. This is how Israel was created. They forced out at least 750,000 men, women, and children. And of course, these refugees, like all refugees, have the right to return home. There are international principles of justice enshrined in international law, but they're just also enshrined in common morality. All human beings have certain rights. We cannot sacrifice those rights for some groups of people because we think, well, we won't bother upholding those rights. All human beings have many rights, and among them is the right to return to your home. But of course, these refugees are not being allowed to return to their home by Israel. I'm almost at the end of my talk, but I'll tell about one person who tried to tell Americans at the time about what was going on. Her name was Dorothy Thompson. According to the Britannica Encyclopedia, Dorothy Thompson was one of the most famous journalists of the 20th century. One place they call her the most famous, the most important female journalist of the 20th century was Dorothy Thompson. And yet I had never heard of her. Almost nobody has heard of her. But she was very famous. She had a newspaper column that was read all over the country, a radio program listened to by millions of Americans. She was such a celebrity that there was even a Hollywood movie loosely patterned on her life, in which she was played by a famous Hollywood actress, Katharine Hepburn. She was a wonderful journalist. In the 1930s, she had been a journalist in Europe, and she had, in Germany, she had been one of the first journalists to alert the world to Hitler. She was the first journalist to be expelled by Hitler. Because of that, she was sympathetic, very sympathetic to Zionism. But then after the war and after Israel was created, she went over to see this wonderful new Jewish state that had been created, and she discovered Palestinian refugees, hundreds of thousands of them, living in destitution, dying in large numbers under very harsh conditions. So she began to write of them, to speak of them, to tell of them. She even at one point made a documentary about them. And because she was telling Americans about these people, she lost her newspaper job, she lost her radio program, and she was largely erased from history. And yet, here finally we have some good news. Despite these decades of manipulation And despite the media filtering and misinformation that Americans are getting, the interesting fact is that Americans, the large majority of Americans, say we should not take sides. That means that over two-thirds of the population is very receptive to the facts. They've never really gotten the facts. And yet this position that they say we should take is the right one. Because that means we would stop our massive amount to Israel. We would stop vetoing resolutions on behalf of Israel. And we would be a fair broker. So the majority of our population, and not just a majority, not just 51%, a resounding majority wants the right solution. The reason we're not getting it yet is because they're not voting on that. Most of us aren't yet voting on it. They don't know, they don't have strong views. This isn't something they ask their candidates about. But that's our job, because what we can do is that the way to bring change, and it is our duty, I feel, as you can see, to bring change. It's our duty as human beings. It's our moral duty. It's our religious duty for all of our religions. We're morally required to do this. It's also our patriotic duty as Americans to bring change. Now, how do we do that? The way that you bring change is the voters. We're very fortunate. We're living in a democracy where we can do this at the ballot box. When we have enough people at the ballot box with us, we can do this. And the American public has done that before. We have demanded policies change, and we have managed to change them. Our job is to inform our fellow American voters so that we will bring about the change that will benefit everybody. That's our job, is to tell them, now how do we do that? There are lots of ways we can do that. I'll just mention a few. Something as simple as talking to your colleagues at work or your fellow students. I meet people around the country that are like myself. They're not Muslim or Arab. They didn't know about this, but they're working on Palestine. And I ask them, what woke you up? How did you learn about this? And in many cases, they'll say, well, there was another student in my class who told me about it. Or somebody will say, I had a colleague at work who told me about it. So that's an important step right there. But also, you can try to use the media. Now, it might be difficult, it might not work. But often, more often than we expect, we can get letters to the editor in the newspaper, especially smaller newspapers, write op-eds. Every time you get information into a newspaper, it is a triumph. Every time there's a fact that the general public is reading that they would not know otherwise. It's very important. Remember, Zionists did all of this. They didn't just talk. They did hard work. They did this. There's public access TV. You can have programs on TV. It's free. You can look into that. You can put on open houses and events, invite the public to come in to learn about this. Reach out to churches. In a number of cases, I've been able to speak in churches. People are very receptive. A number of masjids around the country have made connections with churches. They become friends. They meet one another. They start to learn about Palestine that way. That's very powerful. You can put on something as simple as a Palestinian Cultural Day, where it's as many people come as possible. Everybody comes, and the general public is invited, where they'll learn about, there'll be music, and the wonderful food, and, you know, fashions, and you know, embroidery. And that, again, makes people say, oh, I guess they're not all terrorists. You know, they see that, and that starts to, all of these things make a difference. You know, it's surprising, but groups around the country are doing this type of thing with significant success. Now, some people, this is one more thing. You can get my book because it opens eyes. It has already sold over 10,000 copies. It's now over 13,000 copies on Amazon. We haven't even marketed it to bookstores and libraries yet. We don't even, you know, we haven't even done that yet. But on Amazon, it's already gotten over 200 customer reviews. And many people that are, you know, just have American names say, eye-opening. I had no idea. Every American should read this book. So some people are getting it and giving it to their children's history teachers, to friends, to professors. That's one more tool that you could perhaps make use of. And then some people, I've heard of the problems with the Houston Chronicle. I hear these types of things around the country. Sometimes they're almost insurmountable. You know, I don't know about the situation here, what you can get in there. But let me point out something to you. I bet it would be nice to see something like this. Imagine a political cartoon that actually tells about Netanyahu, the way he treated our president of the United States, Barack Obama. Imagine that, getting that in the Houston Chronicle. Well, guess what? That was in the Houston Chronicle. I was researching the website today of the newspaper to see its coverage, and I found that cartoon. So that gives me hope that, you know, the person in charge of the editorial page may not be a Zionist. The person above him might be, but it still is worth a try, because if you can't get information in there, and I imagine you probably can, that can be a very important step. So these are all things that you can do. Another thing that we're doing, then once you have enough people, then everybody tells our elected representatives that we want different policies. I tell them frequently that I don't want any more of my tax money going to Israel. That's an improper use of my money. When enough people do that, as they have done in a few congressional districts, those elected representatives change their voting record, unless they're hardcore Zionists. But most are not. Most are just doing what they think they have to do, because if the voters are not aware, and if they try to do something for Palestine, the Zionist lobby funnels money to their opponent, and they lose their election. But if they do it in a community where the voting public knows about Palestine and wants them to do it, then they can and will do it. So it's our job to make it possible for them to do it. And if they don't do it, to vote them out of office. That's how it works. Making the world better is not easy, but I think making the world better is a hard thing to do, but together, we can do it. Thank you. Okay, sorry, it went so long.
Okay, no problem. I guess I'll announce real quick.
Okay.
If you can have a seat, then you can come back to the podium. Back to the announcements.
Okay.
You got you. Thanks.
First off, I would like to for attending. Can y'all hear me now?
Yes.
Alright, so first off, I would like to thank Ms. Allison Weir for attending IEC and essentially educating us on the spring inside and also her books available. A small announcement, her book signing will be at the library after the event, after a small Q&A. And so you guys are more than welcome to attend the book signing and purchase her book. Before, and that is after the small Q&A. And again, we would like to thank all of you on behalf of IEC. We'd like to thank IEC for letting us have this small program for this education seminar. And then we would also like to, we're trying to put the RISE website on there just to get people familiar with some of the things we're working on. We have continuous blogs, we have continuous seminars such as these to just create this awareness among the Americans and the general public of what's happening and how we can make an impact overall with this global issue. So as long as soon as that loads up, until then, I'd like to thank all of you again. And I would like to invite Brother Mahdi to come up and take part of the Q&A.
Thanks for coming, and I think I speak on behalf of all of us where certainly your, how objective you are and how much courage you have is certainly very inspiring. I'm just going to open up the floor for questions, and we are short of time, so we'll just keep it brief. If you have a question you'd like to ask, please raise your hand and I'll...
Firstly, thank you so much for coming out here. I think it's fantastic, the work that you're doing. We're grateful to you for doing all of this. My question is, why Palestine? Why didn't you just give them a state in the United States and everybody could be happy?
That's a good question. Hello? Oh. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Did you hear the question? The question was, why Palestine? Why not give them just a state in the United States? That was there's a joke that was said to Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, one time. Why not be the 51st state? And he said, because then we would only have two senators. Palestine, originally, the original founders of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl in particular, and the others with him, were very secular. So they considered other locations, Argentina, Uganda. Herzl was very willing to take Uganda. The British were offering that. But because of the biblical connection that was sort of a good selling point, they felt, to Palestine, and there was a sentimental connection there, that's why they chose Palestine, even though most religious Jews, even though they chose it for sort of a biblical connection, considered it heretical, because the Jewish theology was that God had dispersed them and that it was a Messiah that would bring them back, not a political ideology and not at the force of a gun.
Okay, we have a question from over here.
Hi, you mentioned how we can take control of our tax money, and how exactly would we do that with the officials here, or what are some ideas to be able to start doing that?
What we can do is, we can't ourselves, but well, there are two types of things we can do. One thing is more and more of us can tell your congressperson, whoever that is, and the candidates when there's an election, that you don't want your tax money to go to Israel. You want to, this is what I would do. Everybody should make their own decision. But I say, I don't want any more American tax money to go to Israel. It's a failed policy. It fuels violence. It just causes more and more violence. It's not making things better, it's making things worse, and I want the tax money to stay here in the United States. You know, that type of message. But they won't do it yet. You know, you give them the message, they'll just nod, and then they'll say, well, Israel needs it, they'll say it's our ally or something. But when they hear from enough people, that's when they will do it. So it's worth doing it, but it's equally important, even more important, to tell more people so that they're hearing it from enough people that after a while they start to think, looks like my voters want this. And in those cases, I don't know who your representative is, but in some cases, they would love the voters to make them do it. They'd rather take that position, but they can't, because if they took that position right now, then the other candidate would get lots of pro-Israel money, campaign donations, and then the other candidate would have wonderful billboards all over and TV advertising and a very skilled campaign team and would win the election, and the people of Houston wouldn't even know what it was about. So it's, you know, the way to get out to more people is
As I said, letters to the editor, putting on events. Also, I didn't get a chance to show you, but we have billboards that we can put up here. It costs, you know, between $2,000 to $4,000 per month. You can put a billboard on these highways that says $8 million per day to Israel doesn't make sense. And then it has a website where they go and learn more. So putting up billboards can be very effective. Talking about the money. At Christmas, we talk about Bethlehem. So that's another way to reach more people with the facts. Then when there are enough people, there's the campaign to have everybody stop the blank check to Israel. We have a website that says stop the blank check to Israel, where people can sign that statement and put their zip code so that that can be a campaign.
Thank you. There seems to be Zionist control of the mic.
And of the clicker.
I read your book, and I think I would encourage every American to actually have it in their home and give it to their friends. I was surprised that how they manipulated Harry Truman's election, and the fact that Harry Truman thought that he was leaning more towards a one-state solution, like the current discussion bit. That's the comment. But the question is, what do you think about the BDS moment? Do you think that is something that can happen with a divestment against the apartheid regime?
Yes, I do. I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to go into that, and then I thought I should give more time for another question. I am very much in favor of the BDS movement. That's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It mostly consists of boycotts. So if you're on a, if you're a student on a campus, most campuses have investment portfolios, you know, of course. And most campuses have regulations where the money is not allowed to be invested in an apartheid regime. These kind of regulations came in during the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa. So in a university, students can organize and go to the university and require and, you know, ask them and try to do it politely at first that they divest, that they follow their own rules and that they divest the money that's invested in companies that do business with Israel, that it's prohibited by their own regulations. The value in that is that they won't just do it. You know, they won't, you know, they'll say no. They'll say, oh, it's not apartheid. So then the students have to put together a whole package showing, yes, it is apartheid. And that research has been done. Lots of groups, including our own, have lots of research that student groups can use. And the value of that is if you divest from it, it's some financial impact, pretty small compared to overall, but it makes it a local issue. So then the students on the campus for the first time, you know, again, Palestine seems far away. There's so much going on in young people's lives in addition to their studies that it's hard to get them to come. But once it's a local issue and there's all controversy and, you know, should the Board of Regents or the Board of Governors divest from Israel and why should they? And then there's a lot of discussion. And it's a way to educate all those students because then they're interested. Once people are interested, then we can give them the facts. So it's valuable for that. And several campuses have now succeeded in actually getting divestment passed. And that does will eventually even have some sort of financial impact as well. So I'm very much in support of the BDS movement.
And just trying to keep us there.
Are there any sisters? Because we're trying to wrap this up because it is getting late. And we do, of course, have the book signing, but still have this. Are there any sisters that wanted to pose a question before we wrap it up on this side? I know there were a few brothers
there's numerous. I don't think we're going to have time for all of them. There's like five different brothers who are trying to pay attention. This brother here has been waving his hand for a while, and there's another brother in the back.
Firstly, I would greatly appreciate your research and your efforts in this direction. I'd be interested in knowing if you have faced any significant threats or other hostilities in your efforts in this direction.
Thank you. Yes, I have. I was in a debate on the University of California, Berkeley campus a number of years ago, a very fair debate organized by the student body and moderated by the Dean of Students. And after the next day, apparently my side did very well, because the next day we had a voicemail on our office machine saying, "I heard the debate last night. Me and my buddies trained by the Israeli military are going to come in and kill all of you. Don't come into the office, we're going to kill you all." So we, you know, we got that death threat. Of course, here I still am. So we actually turned it against them. You know, first of all, they are, as I expect you know, but I wouldn't have known before, they are potentially violent. You know, that could be a real threat to take seriously. They've killed people in the United States. But I knew most likely it was a bully. You know, a coward is a bully, and they call, you know, call late at night and everything. So, but we took it seriously. You know, we notified the police, we notified the FBI, we demanded that we have protection. Fortunately, at the debate, we had had security there. So I had an off-duty Berkeley policeman had escorted me to the debate. Then that meant he heard the debate. And then he was very supportive and very interested, you know, as we were walking back to my car. So the next day, when I wasn't getting much reaction from the Berkeley Police Department, I called him, because he'd given me his card. And then he, you know, made sure we got a lot of help. And we also, you see, you know, you make lemonade out of lemons. So we then went to the media and also sent out press releases to the campus newspaper, the Berkeley newspaper, the San Francisco newspaper, about a death threat from having taken part in a debate on a campus. And, you know, people don't like death threats. So, you know, that got a lot of attention. And in fact, the Dean of Students and the Chancellor of the University of California publicly supported us because of that. So fortunately, I think by all of those activities, that made me and everybody else safer, because it showed it just backfired. It hurt them. You know, if they actually did something to hurt me, it would backfire, you know. I think I'm surprised they aren't here helping my sore throat, because everybody will blame them if something happens to me. So there are, you know, I get called, you know, terrible names. I don't like that. It's really unpleasant, truthfully, to hear that and to read about that. There are websites, whole websites that attack me. There are attempts to infiltrate the movement and call me anti-Semitic from within the movement, too. The more effective you become, the more you'll be attacked. But, you know, that's just to be expected. It's not. On the other hand, I've met wonderful people of all sorts, all over the country and all over the world. So overall, the positives have far outweighed the negatives.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Ms. Allison Ware again for her time and efforts for coming down here. And again, reminding everyone that there will be snacks and refreshments outside. But before we departure for the book signing and library, I would like to remind everyone that the RISE organization that you see the website for is specifically ran by, and was created, and now we're working, primarily youth is working on this. And so we would like to have more youth involved with this. And so as you can see that these blogs that we're consistently posting every week, or what's happening in Yemen specifically right now, the Israel and Palestinian issue, we continue to do that. The youth, not just in Houston, but also in Austin, and also out of states, collaborate together and work on this. So we like to, you guys, if you're a great writer, and if you like to write blogs or articles or whatever it is, or if you'd like to have more connection with other key organizations such as CARE,
collaborating with CARE tomorrow with their banquet. I urge everyone to come and participate in that. Also, she's speaking, Ms. Allison Burr speaking there also. Yesterday, we had an event with SJP. We worked with them. So if you'd like to get involved with other organizations, also if you'd like to write blogs, or if you want to get more involved in the protests for the Hood rally, we will be working toward that also. As mentioned earlier, at the beginning of the program, Ms. Allison Weir being here is the inception and the initiation process of creating the momentum towards the Hood rally. So excuse me speaking really fast, just trying to cut down time. And so this is the website. If any of you would like to volunteer, especially you go to risepeople.org, and there's a contact us tab right there. So you just leave your name and your number of contact information, and how you can possibly giving us a criticism how you can improve it, or how you'd like to volunteer or join the organization essentially. And so, or you can contact me, I'm right here, right now, and then Brother Asim or Brother Mohsin, or anyone in general, or Brother Abid. And so again, we'd like to thank everyone, Ms. Allison Weir specifically. And the book signing will be in the library, so inshallah we'll see you there. And if you have any questions, for those individuals who had questions, and we're not because of the time crunch, didn't get a chance to answer that, you can ask her in the book signing, if you like. So thank you again, and please recite aloud, so.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night